Hello and welcome back to Millennial 8, and now I'm here with Pox Populi. Now, Pox Populi was on Millennial once before in 2018, and then, well, why don't you tell people the story so that I don't get anything wrong? But welcome back.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Woz. It's wonderful to be back on Millennial. It's wonderful to be back chatting voice to voice, if not exactly face to face, as it were. So the last time I was on was 2018. It was in that same year that I had created the Pox Populi YouTube channel. And populism still at that point was, it was still sort of all the rage. And Trump had won, Brexit had been pulled off. Good things were happening as far as populism and nationalism, right-wing populism. As far as that was concerned, in Italy, we had La Lega was voted into power, into a coalition government in Italy. Vox was making gains in Spain. And so I just, I kind of played on that populism trajectory and named that in the channel. And then, I was on Millennial that year, and the very night, like literally hours before going on Millennial, I had just broken up with my girlfriend at that time, and it was one of those sort of pack your bags and walk out the door breakups. It was not a very, this breakup happened, God be with you, and let's go on our separate ways. This was kind of more like a Spanish epic drama sort of breakup. And so literally I'm like,
Did she call you bastardo or something like that?
Yeah, there was lots of similar words were exchanged. And so like just hours before that, then that happened. And then I go on to Millennial, and I don't think I had used my camera on that particular. So that's why I said it's worth chatting face to face now for the first time in years.
I'll just check. I can't remember.
I don't think I turned on because I was, I've actually, now that I was going back and reflecting on, what all happened, I'm actually kind of a bit amazed that I actually managed to pull off the conversation with you considering all that was happening, because then I had to find a place to live. I had to sort of get my life sorted. And I was living in a city where I didn't know anyone. I had moved there with this girlfriend at the time to be with her and to continue the relationship. And so eventually I found myself living underground in a sort of basement underneath a kebab restaurant right across the street from an Irish pub, which ended up sort of saving my life. And so then even if I wanted to make videos or make any stuff really during that time, it would have been impossible anyway, because I didn't have Wi-Fi. I didn't have any sort of internet connection. The place I was living was smaller than a kitchen, really. It was just the first place I could find in a short notice. And so it was kind of
underneath a kebab shop.
Yeah,
That seems so like contemporary Europe, because I remember that's 2018 or 19. I remember in 2017, I was in Freiburg and I stayed there briefly, just a few weeks, with a girlfriend, and there was a pizza place nearby, and I have a fondness for pizzas. It was Turks, it was run by Turks, and that was typical. That was the place that I would walk there, and then Frankfurt, I was there, and it was full of Turks and Arabs, Berlin, of course.
I don't know if
and it's just like that. That seems to be, and then Utrecht, and I remember sitting in a park in Utrecht, and it was all, and it was all foreigners, and that's 5 years ago now, and it's like this is the modern experience. This is the contemporary experience of Europe. I was talking to a young guy, pessimistic idealism, last night, about his first visit to the old world, and it was Italy, and even there, like in rural, in small villages, even there he saw newcomers. So it seems like part of, for you as well, you're American, you visit the old world, you move over, and what's your experience? You see old Europe and Europeans, but it's it's tinged with this. So you get the global cities, you get like Amsterdam, Berlin, and so on, Milan, maybe to an extent. And then then you get the towns and the villages, but everywhere now is tainted. Everywhere is altered. I mean, what is your experience of that? And just, you know, just hearing that you lived underneath a kebab shop, it's like, fuck. How does that happen in Europe? It's just bizarre.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was in the city of Granada, which is not exactly a big city either, but you know, Spain has a large population of Moroccans, as came to the fore recently with the World Cup and all of that. And yeah, Frankfurt, you mentioned, that's a city that was featured in the Becoming a Minority Project, which is a EU-funded research project into various cities across the European continent where the native population is now the minority, and Frankfurt is one of them. Frankfurt, the native German population, has been a minority there for years now. I remember talking about my YouTube channel and going back to the years when I created it. I remember talking about the demography of cities in Europe, and Frankfurt was one of the ones that I featured.
I stayed one night in Frankfurt. And it was awful. I hated Frankfurt. I'll never want to go back there. I mean, it wasn't the worst place I've ever been, but it was like half high finance and that awful, bland corporate thing. And then half Middle Eastern Turk dilapidation and all this. And it was just awful.
Well, this is something like I've traveled around a lot of Europe. For my part, I wouldn't say, you know, I'm a European sort of globetrotter, but I've been to the places that I wanted to go. I've seen the things that I wanted to see. I've experienced the cultures that I've wanted to experience. And at the end of it all, I have to say it was actually quite disappointing. And I almost at times wish I wouldn't have done it, because all I saw ultimately were cities which are all the same. No matter where you go, all the cities are the same now. The populations are the same. You have the same sort of, you know, sub-Saharan Africans selling bracelets and fake, you know, Chinese knockoff Adidas shoes or something on the streets. You have the same sort of shops, the same multinational corporations, the same fast food, American fast food joints popping up everywhere that are increasingly popular with like the younger generations. Now, this is mainly confined to the cities, but you mentioned earlier, just moments ago, that some of the towns are even suffering this. And in the case of Italy, what happens in towns is that there's an influx of Chinese. The Chinese are buying up countries like Italy and like Spain. And so what you'll see is on a macro scale level, various ports and motorways and infrastructure and football clubs will be purchased by Chinese individual billionaires or conglomerations. And then on a sort of micro level in your local community level, the old Italian who used to run, used to own and operate the local cafe or the local tobacco shop. And, you know, maybe he's getting long in the tooth and he wants to retire now. Well, he eventually either sells it to a Chinese person or gets replaced by a Chinaman. And so that's kind of a reflection of what's going on in the macro scale with countries like Europe. And you can see it even starting to affect the demography of smaller mid-sized towns. And then I think once you get into the deep countryside, the little villages, farming communities, then you can actually sort of escape from that. And I did have the opportunity to spend some quality time in those areas. But yeah, so for example, one side of my family in Italy lives in a very small town in the region of Umbria. And it's tucked away in the hills, big rolling green, you know, forest covered hills, medieval ruins dotting the landscapes and things like that. And it's a very big hunting community, very small town. And there's little diversity. There's actually, I think there might be like a Colombian family who lives there, and that's about it. But then in the north where my grandmother lives, in the region of Emilia-Romagna, there, she lives in a bit more of a mid-sized town or city, and there's a lot more sub-Saharan Africans. Like I said, there's the Chinese influx, and it's noticeable. It's definitely noticeable. And
well, everywhere starts to look like, you know, the city in Blade Runner, where it's just a mishmash with a heavy Chinese influence, which was is more recent. You know, at first it was Africans, then Pakistanis, and in Britain, Turks in Europe on the continent. Mm-hmm. But latterly, there have been a lot of Chinese as well, and everywhere just ends up being, as you say, the same. I mean, it's very it's sad to hear you saying that you almost wish you hadn't moved to Europe. Did you have a romantic view of it beforehand?
Oh, it's not that I wish I hadn't moved to Europe. I always knew that I would do it. When I was growing up in America, I felt something. So my mother's side is Irish and my father's side is Italian. My Irish side, my ancestors came from Cork and Monaghan in the late 19th century to the American Midwest to mine copper and tin. And then my father emigrated to America in the 1980s. So my Italian connection was always very strong. We went to Italy a few times when I was a child, sort of on holiday to see the family. And on a few occasions, Italian family came to visit us in America. And I felt a very strong connection to that side of who I am. And, it was also very, very exciting. It was, they were speaking a different language and they brought parcels full of different foods and everything had a different smell. And it was very captivating and alluring. And, their clothes were very different. This is, back before so much globalization and so much homogenization. This was still at a time when, Italians dressed a certain way. They didn't all dress like the modern young Italians nowadays, all dressing like American rappers. Italians had a particular style and a particular way of carrying themselves that was uniquely Italian. And, and as I was getting older into my teenage years, sometimes the food that I would pack in my lunch was, Italian cured meats and cheeses and my little panino, right? And the other students are kind of looking at me like, what is this guy eating, And then as regards to my Irish side, I think it's something like blood memory, genetic memory. I've just always felt such a call, such an appeal to Ireland, from Ireland, and I have been fortunate enough to spend some quality time there, and I've also in my traveling days met a lot of Irish people and got on very well with them, but it was, for that, it wasn't so much going there on holidays as a child or having any sort of interaction with family members coming to visit me. It was more like the imagery and the sounds of the music and the stories, the folklore. Occasionally on my Telegram streams, I'll open the stream with Celtic folk music, Irish folk music. And that's something that I've been listening to since I was a small boy. And I would just sit and listen to this music and close my eyes and be transported to vistas that I had never seen, but they were appearing in my mind's eye. And I was imagining stories that I'd never lived in, yet I was seeing the characters and I was seeing as if they were right in front of me. In Welsh, there's the expression hiraeth, which means a sort of a feeling of a homesickness for a time and a land that you can't go back to, but you know it's real, but you can't go back to it. And I think that played a role in my feelings towards Ireland. So long story short, is basically just growing up, I always knew that I would move back. And when I turned 18, it was simply a matter of going to the local Italian embassy and getting my Italian paperwork sorted. And then I just moved to Italy and I stayed there for a few years. And then eventually I found a job in France. And I lived and worked in all of that country, really got to explore France quite a lot. And it holds a special place in my heart as well. And the French people do as well. And then I did some, when that job ended, I just kind of used the money I'd saved up to backpack around. And that's when I kind of went to various places around the British Isles, Central Europe. And then a few years ago, I found myself in Spain. What I mean to say when I find myself regretting it is just that and you asked if I had a sort of a romantic view. I did. I think I'm disappointed with the modernity of it all. I'm sad to see, and it's happened in front of my eyes during my lifetime. You know, I've seen the local disparate European cultures, the local national cultures or the local provincial cultures sort of fade slowly, kind of like, you know, the passing of the elves in the Lord of the Rings or something. And it's been increasingly replaced with this global culture, but it's very shallow. It's very bland. It's a culture of, you know, eating Domino's pizza, sat in front of the television, watching Friends on Netflix. And that honestly was a bit of, I remember when I observed that, I observed this happening when I was living with some people in France. And I remember that's how they were spending their evening. And I just thought, I feel like I'm back in America. Yes. What's going on here?
Yes.
It's very off-putting.
I remember it was touted as a sort of wondrous thing about the internet that you can get whatever you want anywhere, wherever you want. And the products of one country are available in every other country. The national borders have become meaningless. Distance has become meaningless. And yeah, it did sound cool to a newcomer, to someone who was naive about it. And we all were back then, you know, in the mid late 90s. It sounded like that sounds great. You know, it sounds amazing. And it was amazing. But the result is that 20 years later, 25 years later, we're very clearly, very quickly lost something. I mean, it's not just the internet. You know, I think it's important to say this. It's also just the globalization more broadly, and especially
it's media culture. It's media culture. It's Hollywood culture. A little bit of is black worship too. The popularity, and I think it's being astroturfed in a way, but it's also, you know, it's sort of like a third world worldification, because I'm seeing, like I mentioned earlier, a lot of younger Italians now are dressing like American rappers. They're dressing like black rappers, and they're using words like drip to say that something is, you know, cool. I don't even know these expressions, really. I'm having to inform myself, because I used to be an English teacher and I had a lot of classes of teenagers. And so, you know, I would like this, you know, sort of keep up to date with the lingo and maintain my position as the cool teacher, right? And then, you know, I just was, like I said earlier, it's kind of this strange thing of like, why are so many Italians, young Italians, dressing and talking like black Americans and listening to rap music and drip and all this stuff? And then in Spain, it's reggaeton, which is sort of like South American, you know, brownoid music. And it's very, very basic. The rhythm is almost like just caveman simplicity. It's just a simple dun-dun-dun-dun beat, and then impose over that are just lyrics about, you know, fucking hoes, right? Woes is hoes. And this music now is just everywhere all throughout Spain, where if you go into any restaurant, any bar, if you listen to the music, you know, passing car's radio, it's all reggaeton. And it's very strange. It's just like, what are we doing? You know, it's very alienating. So yeah, this is kind of like the global homo culture that we always rail about. This is that lived out. This is what it's like.
Oh yeah, this is not something theoretical. It's there already. I mean, in London, there's an even worse manifestation of it, though, because you see young white people who sound black, and it's not because they're aspiring. It's not because they think, oh, I want to be like an American rapper. It's because they are surrounded, like engulfed in black people of their own age who set the tone. Mm-hmm. And so the white kid ends up having to conform. I mean, he might have had two white parents who raised him quite well, and they wanted him to sound, you know, civilized and English and all that. But no, in the playground at school, he has to start speaking like that, this fucking dreadful, dreadful modern accent. Sorry to anyone listening who speaks with that accent. I don't want to degrade you. I don't want to mock you, but it's just objectively.
But it is sort of performative, and especially when you think about how, in the case of a country like England, to a lesser extent, Mediterranean countries, but you know, a particular country like England, the native identity is disparaged. And, you know, English people are told that their food is bland and boring and that they have no real culture apart from like Morris dancing or something.
It's just absolutely unbelievable. You know, again, I'm sorry to keep mentioning this Telegram channel, but this Forgotten History UK, I substituted a few days ago and I keep sharing stuff from it. And it's just sort of blowing my mind. You know, it really shows you we absolutely had our own culture. There's just no question. Mm-hmm. I mean, it is absolutely there. In fact, I sent a particular picture to somebody else so I can get it to you easily. Hold on a second. I'll just show you one single photo from this. This is from London, Spitalfields area of London in the late 60s. Have a look at that. So this is the site of a newsagent's, I guess. They're selling Lion's shortbread, different types of washing powder there. You can't really see it very clearly. But the point is, this could be nowhere but England, possibly exactly. Scotland. But even Scotland, I don't think that looks Scottish. I know how Scottish architecture looks of that era. It's England. And it couldn't be Germany. It couldn't be France. It couldn't be Italy.
You know, even the cars in the background, we can get a sense of the time. We can get a sense of the date when this photo was taken. Whereas, you know, I think a few months ago on your Telegram channel and as well as on mine, there was sort of this cross Telegram conversation going on about how culture doesn't seem to have advanced in like 25 years.
God.
How everything kind of looks the same. Music sounds like it did. Music today still kind of sounds like it did 15 years ago. Fashion hasn't really... There's no particular fashion that could say, "Oh, that's a picture from 2012," or "Look at that car, that's a 2010 model of a Peugeot or something." Whereas just looking at that picture, you know, you can kind of tell, even just from that little glimpse of the cars in the background, when was this picture taken? Where was this picture taken? And nowadays, I think that we've kind of lost that in a significant way. And so, basically, what I was going to say about the black culture and the adoption of sort of different accents that can happen in a country like England. It's also starting to happen in a country like Italy, which doesn't have so much of the disparaging of its national culture or identity. Italians are quite, you know, chauvinist about our culture. You know, it's kind of, there's a joke that we don't have, you know, a culture of stand-up humor, a culture of comedy like they do in Britain, because we can't self-deprecate. We have good weather, we're all good looking, and we have excellent food. What are we gonna make fun of ourselves about? So there isn't so much of a degradation of the local culture, but there is a sort of worship of these waves of African arrivals as almost like exotic demigods, and everything they do is so cool, or you know, they're such good people, they've overcome such adversity. And if only we could just be as good-hearted as the Africans. And so one of the things I see frequently in Italy would be like, you know, the style icons, the cultural icons are increasingly Africans. with all of their strange, you know, get-ups that they wear, sort of, you know, like the rapper apparel, weird color combinations, all that kind of, you know, the kind of stuff that you know, rappers get up to. And so then I think what that's causing is that as the younger generations who are born into this and grow up with this, they're kind of like, well, yeah, okay, then I guess if I want to be cool, this is what the culture is telling me is cool. This is what the culture is telling me are basically better versions of Italians or better versions of Spaniards or, in the case of, you know, a country like England, better versions of English people.
Yeah, so, something more with it, something more modern, something more aware. Whereas to be like old-fashioned English or to be old-fashioned Italian is to be some sort of laughable dead thing and lacking self-awareness. I think that part of, you know, if I think back to the notion of the concept of being cool, as I, and that's a word that I started, it was there in the 80s. I guess I would have said it as a small child, but definitely it was there in the 90s and I still use it now. And I think part of that concept is being aware and being self-aware to some extent, but definitely being aware of cult, of society and other people and all that. It's not being sort of a dolt and naive and whatever. That's sort of embedded in the concept, as much as to have any intrinsic qualities as well. And I guess that the opposite of that is to lack awareness, to be kind of dumb and stupid. And I think that's very much how traditional European cultures are now characterized as something silly. It's some, you know, a very depressing thing. I was. I'm sorry, I don't want to blackpill people, but a good example of this is I was talking to a young, well, I say young, he's 30, younger than me, guy who grew up in London. Yeah, he grew up in multicultural London. And I was trying to, I was raving about this sitcom from the 70s called Rising Damp. And I think he must have gone off and watched some clips from it. And he came back and he said, you know, I just can't get into this stuff. It's old. It's and what he meant, and he elaborated, I can't remember exactly what he said, but the gist of it was, it's a different time. He can't identify with the Britain that is depicted in this program. It's just, it's too distant from the Britain that he has always known. That's a crime. It's a travesty that's happened. Because that's a program from the 70s. It does hark back to an earlier era still, like the 50s. But still, it's from the 70s. People could watch it then and recognize it. And, you know, and definitely in the 80s, and the, definitely in the 80s, you still saw these 70s TV sitcoms like Dad's Army, Fawlty Towers. They were constantly repeating them on TV still in the 90s. So for my generation, it was easy to, if not, it was easy to watch a program like that and recognize it and understand it, understand the social mores, the conventions, the habits of the characters. There'd be still some stuff that was a bit cryptic, but by and large, you could get them. But I think for someone 10 years younger than me, it's just gone. It's just alien. He cannot understand it, cannot identify with it. And I think this is absolutely awful. You go.
No, it's just what came to my mind just listening to that was, you know, it's sort of like Europe is tired. This was kind of something that Douglas Murray talked about in his book, The Strange Death of Europe. It's so strange, right? And he identified several problems and never identified any solutions to them. But the chapter that always resonated with me, the one that really, apart from all the statistics about the crimes and the rapes and the cost, that chapter where he writes about maybe Europe is just tired and maybe, you know, the problem, one of the problems with this sort of strange death of Europe, because no one's killing Europe, it's just dying of its own accord, apparently. But the, one of the reasons that he sees it that way was because Europe has just, it has such an exhausting history. We've come out of two world wars in one century. and Europe is just tired and its best days are behind it. And when you look at what is being promoted culturally and what young people are tuning into and being inspired by, if they're being inspired at all, it's not coming from home. It's all coming from somewhere else, whether it's the American media culture or drill rap music is very popular in the Anglosphere, in Ireland, in the United Kingdom, or whether it's this sort of exotic, almost worship of the African arrivals coming into countries like Italy. I mean, I even saw this. This was all over the place during the World Cup. The team of Morocco went quite far. They managed to get to the semifinal. And all over Italian sports newspapers, all over Italian Twitter, Spanish Twitter, the whole zeitgeist that they were trying to create was Morocco is now everyone's favorite second team. Everyone's going to, all the neutrals are going to cheer for Morocco. We all love Morocco now. Go on, three cheers for Morocco. And I remember just thinking and commenting on a few of these publications, like, no, I don't care about Morocco. Every time their team is involved in a match, it's a national security issue for European countries and cities. There's another team that's a small nation of 4 million. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to say, haven't they been rioting in London, Belgium, Germany,
everywhere,
France? Everywhere. I can't remember. And they've been rioting everywhere. And, the only thing that comes to mind when I think of Morocco is gay white men 50 years ago would go there to get some, Moroccan, some native twink. And the other thing that comes to mind is, I know that because I watched a film about Joe Orton. And the other thing that comes to mind is the brutal rape and murder of those two Nordic girls. And that's all I know about Morocco. Now, I dare say that there is a lot more to Morocco. But the point I'm making is, if it were an impressive culture that we had much to learn from, I would probably know much more about it already. The fact that those are the only two reference points I have. I mean, come on, let's not kid ourselves. It's a fucking backwards.
For me, it was just such a blatant manifestation of the demigod status that I was mentioning earlier. That and it's also very patronizing. It's very condescending. It's almost like, oh, look at the, it's like a pat on the head or a pat on the back. Oh, look at the little Moroccans. They've done so well, and now we're all going to cheer for them. It's the first time an African nation has made it this far. Are they an African nation or they're an Arab nation? Because depending on the headline or depending on the narrative, they're an African nation or they're an Arab nation. Even politicians, even the president of Spain, Pedro Sanchez, was more effusive in his congratulatory message to the Moroccan team than he was ever about the Spanish team. It was just, it's all of that. It's that sort of, pathologically altruistic, liberal, sort of midwit person who just wants to express publicly their affinity for exotic peoples or the peoples who are, marginalized in our communities. Because the smaller nation of only 4 million people, the smaller European nation, which also went very far in this World Cup, Croatia, doesn't get this kind of treatment. No one is bending over backwards to outdo the other person in their public display of their affinity towards Croatia or Croatians. In fact, there were many people on Twitter that I saw, this was kind of getting shared around my Telegram chat group during the matches, was that there was lots of seething brownoids screaming, if you support the Croatia team, you're a racist. Every goal they score is a goal for white supremacy or something. And they were saying it unironically, so we were just kind of laughing about that.
Yeah, I guess they found that probably works. I remember seeing some, it must have been about 4 years ago. I think it was in Germany. And there was some protest. Some migrants were moaning about their conditions or something. And then one of them was this black guy who was out front. He was more sort of gutsy than the others, and he was talking to this crowd of I think it was Germans, and he said, you do this to us because you are a racist. And it was like, okay, that's the killer blow there. He's just said that he used the word he, and you can imagine a lot of Germans would hear that and think, oh, Well, maybe we are. Oh, it's pathetic. But you know, you understand why it's happened, because they've had decades and decades of this brainwashing. One thing I wanted to get back to was, you talked about Douglas Murray. Now, he rightly gets a lot of criticism for this thing about the strange death of Europe, and who knows why this is happening, and all that kind of really annoying faux naivety, when he knows damn well that there are powers involved in this. He works for them. He always has done. He is a charlatan. But at the same time, and I'm not even saying this to defend him, I've got no interest in defending the guy. I'm just saying that for its own sake, I think he is correct in saying that Europe is tired. I think there is a spiritual momentum, a certain lifespan to a civilization. And I think that, there is a certain weariness about Europe. That is a factor. And it's probably what enabled certain powers to take advantage. I don't think that it wasn't an open door that they walked into. I think it was we were in a vulnerable condition already. Mm-hmm. We were losing some sort of momentum.
And even
go on. Yeah.
Well, I agree with that take on Douglas Murray 100%. And I made, back in the 2018 days when I was making the first videos on my channel, I made quite a few videos about Douglas Murray's book. And I was very effusive in my praise of it. And then because I try to be intellectually honest, first and foremost with myself, and because I always try to maintain a perspective of pro-European nations, and when I refer to the nation, I'm referring to the people, or if you want to be more precise, ethno-nationalism. And that's kind of the pillar that holds up how I look at things going on in the world. And my opinion on Douglas Murray started to go down a bit when, this is when the wool was pulled over my eyes. And it was very quickly, I was just like, well, if this is how he's going to behave, and this is how he's going to, speak publicly about these issues, then he's, like you said, a charlatan. And it was when he did this sort of sit down, hour long interview with Jordan Peterson.
Oh my God.
And they spent the entire time kvetching and hand-wringing and this is a man, Douglas Murray, who has identified all of these problems of Islamic extremism. The subtitle of his world-famous book, which sold millions of copies and made him a very wealthy man, is Islam and Immigration. He knows what's going on. He knows who are the aggressors. He knows who are causing the problems. And yet he and Jordan Peterson spent an entire hour sat across from each other in luxurious armchairs, kvetching about generation identity and European nationalists and the right-wing reaction to the very problems that he had written an entire book about. And this is what annoyed me about him, was that you can't write an entire book about this. Put Islam and Immigration, the subtitle of your book, which has a very provocative title. The title in itself is provocative enough. And then the subtitle as well. And then just say that the people who are on the streets, on the ground, trying to form some sort of resistance to this problem and address this problem, they're the villains. They are the ones who give you most concern and keep you awake at night, and the potential backlash of them.
Yeah. And this is just outrageous. And it's important to say that Generation Identity were never anti-Semitic, or anti-Jew, or whatever you want to say. They never even mentioned it. They made a very specific point of not talking about that. So that's not the issue here. The issue here is simply ethno-nationalism.
Anyone who took up a pro-European cause, and that's what's so annoying is that how. And I eventually did make a video calling them out. I'm a nobody, but I just felt like I had to do it, especially because I'd made videos praising that book. But you cannot sit there for an hour and disparage and wring your hands and clutch your pearls about the only groups in Europe who are actually trying to do something about problems that you yourself have identified and problems that yourself are going to cause disastrous consequences.
Yeah. Those two men,
And just one other thing too.
They should be ashamed of themselves, but that's not really powerful enough. I mean, they are absolute traitors and charlatans and liars.
Yeah.
And they've made a huge amount of money, each of them, from doing that. But I don't even care about the money. It's the damage that they're doing.
Exactly.
I just
because where's Generation Identity now? Where some of the groups that they were naming specifically and criticizing and signaling as, you know, oh, we've got to watch out for the rise of the right wing in Europe. Like, these groups were subverted and attacked and put under the microscope unto utter oblivion now, where they no longer exist. So thanks, Douglas. Thanks, Jordan. They're really, you know, helping the team. But of course, they're not on our team.
I mean, you've got to wonder, what are they doing? I mean, what would they say they're doing? I know what they're doing, but I wonder, what would they say they're doing? You know, if you're going to moan about these problems and then attack the only people doing anything about the problems, well, how can you justify? I would be interested to hear how Douglas Murray in particular would justify this. As for Jordan Peterson, I think he's even further gone than Douglas Murray, because, I mean, he's specifically said his greatest achievement was to ward young white men away from ethnic collectivism. I mean, you know, we don't need to get into it. It's everyone knows what we would say about it. I just think, I mean, I think Douglas Murray is a fairly straightforward case. He's just a charlatan. He's just a traitor. Jordan Peterson is psychologically more interesting, because I think he's unbalanced, kind of mad, cracked. I don't know what you would say, but I don't think he's just doing it for the money. I think there's something quite wrong with the guy. I think he's actually, it's almost like he's been selected to be a public figure because he's psychologically damaged.
Well, he has that famous, or infamous rather, I suppose, history involved with, he co-wrote a United Nations document about, if I recall correctly, it specifically is about immigration and the future of demography in Western nations and, you know, how the world is going to look. And he was a co-author of a paper on that. I think this is a person who is troubled by his own delusions of worst case scenarios, and he sees that there's a Holocaust around every corner, and so anything that's going to recall the gas chambers or something is just sends him into a conniption, because also those are his employers and those are his friends in high places who I'm sure are also encouraging him to take this kind of make these kind of messages and take these positions. And also he was very, very hypocritical and weak over the past couple of years with COVID mandates and vaccine mandates and things like that. You know, you amassed an army of devoted, mainly young men, because you spoke so eloquently about standing up to tyranny and standing up for what you believe in. And yet when we can all see, especially the kind of people who take a liking to Jordan Peterson, can all see that we're being tyrannically forced to do something that we don't believe in. There's Jordan Peterson on his live streams or video chats, whatever, saying, get the damn vaccine, and all these, it just completely flaking on that issue.
He's just a dreadful role model, a dreadful public speaker, because he continually falls prey to his own weakness, which makes him do things that and advocate things that a real man wouldn't advocate. I mean, he's not a very impressive man, to say, you know, to put it mildly.
Yeah, ultimately, I think I've come to that conclusion. You know, this was someone that, during the 3 years that have passed since we spoke, my opinion on these men has changed. Before, I was more, like I said, that conversation between Douglas Murray and Jordan Peterson really, really poisoned the well for me regarding them. And it was actually, after that, it wasn't too much of an effort to start seeing them in a different way. But before that, you know, I bought Jordan Peterson's book, and I, of course, I'd, you know, had read Douglas Murray's book as well. And I just wanted to go back to that part about where you agree with him. And I think that was it's a good take as well, that he is right in that chapter about how Europe is tired. But I would also wonder if that's also not very strange either. Of course, Europeans are going to be tired when for decades, for generations, we've been told not to celebrate our own cultures, that all of our ancestors were basically racist. Even the ones that fought the Nazis are apparently just as culpable of the Holocaust too. Our cultures aren't any special. We don't take pride in them. We elevate the exotic cultures to a pedestal in our own countries while disparaging our native traditions and our native cultures and forgetting them entirely. We've all been reduced to sort of numbers and consumers constantly, not by accident. And so, of course, we're tired. Of course, there's generations that are not inspired by their own culture, their own people, their ancestors' accomplishments. And they also, of course, have no vision for the future. They have no imagination for the future because it's been ground out of them by people who have names and who control the education system, the culture, the media, the arts and entertainment. I mean, just for example, you know, it's going to maybe sound like a strange example. The Marvel films about Thor. Okay. This just came up moments ago, so I guess it's in my mind for this reason. I don't know anything really about comics. I didn't see any of the Avengers films, but I did see, I suppose I didn't, that's not correct, because I saw one of the Thor films with my girlfriend, and then we watched, I think we tried watching some of the other ones, and they were really bad, so we just gave up. Now, the character is based off of a comic book character, okay, but the comic book character is based off of a god, a European god figure, right? An important figure in Germanic and Norse mythology who is worshipped by people. You've had them on as guests. The people in our community who are practicing pagans, this is an important figure in their ethno-faith. And the way that Thor, the character, is treated in these films, they make a mockery of him. He's the butt of the joke. He's a laughingstock. Instead of him being celebrated as the protector of mankind who takes on the world serpent and you know, fights off to knowing he strides forth knowing that he's going to die in the Battle of Ragnarok, but he does it anyway because it's his destiny and he knows that that's his fate to fight this last battle and die a hero or whatever, even if the comic book stories are not quite the same as the Eddas, the mythologies, whatever. But just the fact that they took this uniquely European character, this fundamentally European character, and they reduced him to a joke, to a mockery, that does not inspire the people of Europe. That's not going to inspire the younger generations. They're going to see just a laughingstock, a joke. But then Black Panther, now this gets interesting. Black Panther is specifically designed and then celebrated specifically for its representation of young Black men, of Black culture, African culture, how Africa could have been if it wasn't for evil whitey taking all their stuff, you know, whatever the narrative that they're trying to go with. But there's headline after headline, there's take after take, there's moviegoers, audience members after audience members saying that, oh, it was so important for me and my son to see a positive representation of an African culture, African superheroes, etc. So there's a positive vision for them, whereas the European character was disparaged, insulted, and turned into a joke. And maybe that's why a lot of us feel tired and a lot of European culture feels like it's reached a point of exhaustion and there's no vision of the future or anything like that, because these kinds of things are happening.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I can remember right-wingers, the standard right-wing, well, okay, so let's say 10, 15 years ago, lefties would say it's cruel that young Black men don't see film stars who look like them, who something for them to look up to, role models. And the standard right-wing response to that was, why does skin color matter? Why do they need role models who look like them, who are of the same race as them? It's racist to care about such things. But, well, you see where I'm going. I mean, now we're in this position where, okay, there are no white role models for young white men. And I mean, of course, it's ridiculous to say, why do kids need role models who look like them and who are of the same race as them? I mean, it's just obvious. This shouldn't even need to be said. Again, that was the right winger desperately trying not to be, to prove that he's not racist. He doesn't care about race. The Dems are the real racists. The Dems are the ones who care about skin color. So, well, okay, now you've lost that thing. So now there are no young white kids. They watch Hollywood, they watch the modern media, and it's actually got the other way. So they'll see the black guy is cool or drip, and the white guy is a fucking dork. The white guy is some sort of idiot. Or there's
and
no.
And it's also it's just such a missed opportunity. Like I said, okay, those films, like the Thor films, they're mostly based off comics, I imagine. But the comic itself is based off of your European mythology. That, you know, in a healthy culture, in a culture possessed by Europeans, created by Europeans for Europeans, that would have been an opportunity to celebrate the Germanic cultures of our ancestors. And the Germanic peoples are such a fundamental part of the European biospirit. That would have been a chance to celebrate something. Instead, we get this totally subversive nonsense. And the same thing's been done to the Lord of the Rings recently. And again, a lot of the typical right-wing response was, why does the race matter? The elves can be green. It's a fantasy. Who cares what color
they are?
Another,
like, no. That's another thing they'll say is, well, if I can handle there being dragons in this, then I don't need it to be realistic. It's fantasy, which is just another way for them to avoid, to miss the point.
But meanwhile, they're getting steamrolled.
Yeah. Sorry, you go.
No, it's just while they're making those tepid counter arguments, they're just getting steamrolled. They're just getting completely obliterated by people who say, no, actually, we want to see a brown Snow White. No, we want to see black elves. And it's a fucking victory. We are planting a flag in your culture. We are taking it for ourselves and saying, this is ours now. Thank you very much. And we're owning you. And meanwhile, these normie conservatives are just like, well, it's fine. I don't care. I don't see race. The elves could be green. It's a fantasy. Why do I care? It's just so weak. Anyway, you were going to say something.
I think they don't realize. I mean, I think they're basically people who aren't, who are not intellectually curious. They're not inquisitive. They don't realize the game that's being played all around them and that they are actually unwittingly playing along with, taking part in. They're castrating themselves. And it's tragic because you want to get through to them. You want to say, like, wake up. Can't you see? You're actually damaging your own people, your own position, your own country. Nothing that you care about is going to survive this. You're helping to denigrate everything. You're making everything more vulnerable, more precarious. Fucking wake up. Mm-hmm. But the right winger prides himself on not caring about these things. Not not waking up. And somehow he thinks that his country will survive or his economy will survive. Because for a lot of them, that's the only thing they can bring themselves to actually care about. I mean, you know, I just think that the mainstream right is an absolute dead end. I think it's completely... It's like trying to tell a colorblind guy about colors. He just can't see. Well, no pun intended. I mean, he cannot see the reality in front of him. So there we go.
I think one of the things that stood out most, one of the things that was hammered home to me over the past 2 years, was that it's not the normie that is most dangerous and is most responsible for the degradation of our culture and what's holding us back. It's the midwit. It's the person who's so pompously confident in the absolutely wrong opinions, the wrong views on things. But because he's university educated or because he wants to seem like he's above the racist knuckle draggers, you know, or whether it's the COVID stuff or whatever. So they just, you know, they trust the experts and they receive their opinions from the people in the ivory towers, like Douglas Murray, telling them, no, don't worry about racial issues. Don't worry about demographics. It's just let's just intellectualize about this in received pronunciation tones about how strange this all is. But let's not touch any solutions because that might be dirty, icky, racist stuff. And so they're just pompous and comfortable in these midwit positions while the rest of us who want to do something about it get held back.
Absolutely. And Douglas Murray really caters to the midwit. He's mm-hmm. I think he's expert. You could say that that's Daniel Hannan is another one. I don't know if you're familiar with him, but I think what these men have both done is master the art of flattering the midwit and talking to them, making the midwit feel clever, which of course is a rare pleasure for a midwit, you know. So you can understand why it works with them. But I really do agree with you that the midwit is a serious problem. In fact, when you were talking there, I counted, I went through my meme folder and I've actually got 26 memes about the midwit thing.
you kind of foresaw the midwit. Do you remember the videos you had kind of about the various types of liberals? And I think you had one about like the Hoovian liberal who was quite... I think you made that video before the popularization of the term midwit, but it's kind of the foreshadowing of the midwit. You know, that's sort of, you know, I watch Doctor Who, and I believe that in the future will all be a wonderful future where women will be in positions of power. We won't care about gender differences, racial differences, and you know, the world is going to be this wonderful utopia of equality, and we don't have any. Well, civilization will advance so far beyond the small-mindedness of little racists like you. I'm a Hoovian liberal, you know.
Yeah, this was. I'll show you the thumbnail for that video.
That was it.
That was the one. And the whole point there was that you had this type of person who is a Doctor Who fan who thinks that he wants to be like the Doctor Who, the character.
Mm-hmm.
The fan wants to be like that. The guy is highly intelligent, very well traveled, very cultured, very educated, very aware person. And so the midwit fan wants to see himself as being like that. So... Mm-hmm. Well, then you've got him. Then anything that the Doctor does or says, this midwit will adopt as his own ideas. It's a standard tactic, really. I mean, you see it quite a lot. Flattery is a way to persuade people. But with the Doctor Who fan, it's a real thing. I mean, sci-fi fans, fantasy fans, they're all pretty bad, really. But I think that Doctor Who is probably the worst. Contingent here, because of the nature of the main character, because they're all looking up to him. And I remember seeing a thing, it was on, I think it was Den of Geek, about 6 months ago, and I had to rant about it. I was so angry. It brought it all back to me about, because I don't watch the modern Doctor Who. I haven't been on the forums for years and years and years.
Mm-hmm.
So I've kind of forgotten about how awful they are, how nauseating they are. And then I was on Den of Geek a few months ago, and I found this guy commenting under an article, and it just brought it all back. It's like that these fucking people are, I'm trying to find it now, because I went to Telegram and ranted about this prick. I can't find it now, but that's annoying. Let's see if I can.
Well, if you want to look for it, I'll just say that for me, Doctor Who, my Italian father was actually born in London, and he spent a few years growing up in England, and he became attached to some culturally English things, and one of them was Doctor Who, and he kind of got me into it. Growing up, we had the Chronicles of Narnia, the BBC version on VHS. Oh, we had some Doctor Who.
Nice.
Yeah, I love that. I grew up with that. We used to watch it all the time. And we also had some Doctor Who episodes on VHS as well. And Doctor Who as a series always had kind of like humanist messaging, even, you know, going back to its earliest days. Kind of, you know, secular humanism. That kind of was always, you know, at the surface level of the show and what the messages want to get across. And then, you know, I didn't pay much attention to Doctor Who as I was getting older and going off into my own interests and things like that. But I came back to it during the David Tennant years. Actually, I think I did. Actually, I got back into it with Christopher Eccleston, but not too much. But then when David Tennant came in, I really got more involved in it. I said, oh, hold on, Doctor Who is really cool. This is really nice. Okay. And very quickly, I ended up not being able to enjoy it very much because I kind of sussed things out quickly. I have, I guess, a really high bullshit detector. And what I noticed was that was going on during the Tennant years was that, in especially in like future situations, future Earth, all of the military commanders or people in power, the prime minister, they were all female. They were all women. And they would show up, the men around them, and even the doctor
every
would show up.
Every fucking time! Every time!
You know what I'm talking about then. And I've always, always had really high bullshit receptors regarding feminism, even since I was a really small kid. Like, this is, if I had to say, you know, when were you first red-pilled? Well, for as far as feminism goes, since I was six, like, and I was noticing the feminist messages that would be in, like, you know, Saturday morning cartoon commercials, or the messaging that they would show us in our, you know, school textbooks. Just the idea that girls are stronger than boys when reality shows that they're not, or, you know, the dumb husbands in all these sitcoms when my dad is not dumb and he's actually very hardworking and capable and he's not anything like these men that are being, you know, portrayed on these sitcoms. So what's going on here? Meanwhile, the women are always perfect. The mom, the housewife is always perfect. The girls are always showing up the boys, and even in physical activities. And so I started noting this happening with Doctor Who during the Tennant years, and I was just getting really annoyed with, like, every episode. And then it just went completely out of control with like Peter Capaldi. His companion, yes, would be saying things like flatly insulting him for being a man to his face, yeah, or like other characters that were men just being insulted, or male villains would be overcome by the companion taking advantage of how dumb they are for being men. And it was just like, and then I think there was even an episode where they went to Sherwood Forest and met Robin Hood, and he's just some bumbling misogynist asshole or something. Like, it went completely. And now I just see, that, like, now, you know, the Doctor's been a woman. It's now it's a gay black man. Like, the show is just hopeless now. It was the building blocks for that subversion were always there.
Yes. Yes. And I agree. And, you know, you could go back to the start of it, but and there is, yeah, that's true. But what I want to talk about just briefly, and then we'll get back to the more pertinent things. This fucking idiot. It was August last year, and I was on, yeah, I think it is Den of Geek. Yeah, it was. And I wrote this on Telegram. If anyone wants to see a great example of Whovian smugness, oh, I'm so eccentric and so educated. Did I mention eccentric? Just read the comments by Chris Kilby on this page. Goddamned insufferable. He's the archetypical Doctor Who fan. You can tell he thinks he's really, really clever, but actually he's just so fucking tedious. So I linked to the page. I hope some people harassed the guy. And then I screenshotted one of this guy's comments. And I'll put it up on screen here. Look at this.
Oh, God.
So this guy, probably, you know, you just know how he sees himself. You know, mm-hmm, he thinks he's far cleverer than everyone else in the room, even though he'll profess to believe in egalitarianism and equality. Mm-hmm. But no, his cleverness is absolutely key to it. But the trouble is, he's not that clever. So right. he actually is right to believe in egalitarianism because he fucking needs it. He is a midwit.
Yeah.
So mm-hmm. I wrote, posted that on Telegram, and I said, this guy thinks he's the Doctor. I'm telling you, he thinks he's the Doctor about 10 minutes into an episode, pondering some strange object he's bumped into on an alien planet. That's how Whovians see themselves. The Doctor writ Sainsbury's. That's a supermarket chain in Britain, middle mm-hmm. class. It's so pathetic and tiresome. I don't have words for it. Whovians are a subsection of the British population that is so beyond salvation. The whole lot of them should be cattle prodded into an insane asylum so that they can't endanger the rest of us, still less enrage us with their damned tedious affectations. And, you know, that was me after I'd calmed down somewhat from reading this comic, because it is just absolutely enraging. I mean, just look at the smugness. And he doesn't understand anything, but he thinks he does. He thinks he's in a position to talk down to me. And, well, it wasn't even to me, but he certainly would.
To everyone, to everyone.
Yeah, everyone. And he would certainly think that I was some sort of, you know, barbarian, from my opinions. What a fucking cunt.
But then these are the kind of people, too, that during COVID, you know, they would be, especially, you know, taking that Whovian mentality, you could just see them wanting to, you know, like you could just see them as if they were, you know, David Tennant. Look what humans are capable of. Look at this wonderful vaccine they've created. It's going to save billions of lives. Aren't humans amazing? Look at these expert scientists, what they've done. And I believe them. I put my faith in them because I believe in science and the brilliant minds of all humanity coming together to stop this. And it's so wonderful. Get your vaccine. How dare you not want a vaccine? You're such a stupid troglodyte. This is a great advancement of the brilliant human mind, and I know because I watch Doctor Who, and I'm just like him.
I'm open-minded. I'm rational.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm logical. Mm. I'm impartial. I'm not.
I fucking love science.
Exactly. That would be a good precursor of this, which originated around the time of this Doctor Who revival. So yeah, I mean, let's not go on about Doctor Who too much, but I did want to take the opportunity to rant about this guy. I mean, it's just absolutely awful. And it's a really interesting thing where, and it actually touches on quite a profound issue about Western civilization. We no longer have the means, the infrastructure, I guess, to determine what is actually clever, what is actually intelligent, what is actually perceptive, what is actually insightful. And so that means that the midwits can run riot and have a very high, very inflated opinion of themselves. But it also means that people can outwit them all, can trick them all. And that, I think, is a good example of what happened with COVID. Fundamentally, people in multiple spheres, critical spheres in society, aren't doing what they're supposed to be doing. So those spheres aren't performing the social function that they are supposed to perform. Now, one of them would be, obviously, journalists are no longer questioning the government. But another one would be that art is no longer reflecting society, and literature is no longer reflecting people as they actually are. And I talked about this with Litmus a few nights ago. Everything is now a mirage. Everything is a fake version of what it's supposed to be. And so,
but isn't that, in a way, isn't that a reflection of society? Because I think I wouldn't say that it's not a reflection of society. I would say that this is what happens when you have midwits at the controls of everything, who've never lived through anything. They've never learned anything through experience. They've never had to go through anything incredibly trying. These are all very comfortable people. One of the, I think I read it over the course of last year. Might have been before that. But the book, The Ancient Ethnostate by Guillaume Durocher, is a very, very good book. One of the best books written by anyone in our sort of, you know, community of things, for its in-depth analysis and its exploration of a topic that I very much like, which is ancient history, in particular Greek history. And he talks about how the Iliad in particular gives us this example of the decadent cosmopolitan Trojan society and how it put up a good fight. I mean, in the siege of Troy takes actually like 10 years, but in the end, you know, despite their best efforts and despite someone like Hector leading them, they cannot withstand the vital barbarism, as he puts it, of the Hellenes. And this is always repeated in history. This is the cycle of history, that a civilization reaches a decadent phase where as you said, the people who should be in control of things are no longer good at what they're supposed to be good at. And they are just too decadent and too soft and too cosmopolitan and too comfortable. And that will always be met with a more vitalistic, barbaric force, especially in older times when, you know, martial conflict was a bit more common. And so, for example, you look at we talked earlier about briefly about the Rings of Power, right? And how they were race swapping out all the characters and that sort of thing as a conquest of European culture to say that this is ours now. But what's also displayed in something like the Rings of Power is just how bad the quality, the intellect, the creativity of writers is nowadays compared to someone like Tolkien. And what did Tolkien live through? This is a man who lost all of his friends in the First World War. He fought in the trenches. He was involved in a conflict that, you know, killed all his friends. And then his sons went on to fight in the second one. And he had to worry about losing his sons. And he was, you know, there's all sorts of correspondence between him and Christopher and his other sons who are all fighting. So this is a man who lived through things. He lived through things. He knew how to do things. He was capable. He spent time in libraries, poring over encyclopedias and old manuscripts and piecing together the riddles of ancient languages long since spoken. Whereas the writers of the Rings of Power are a bunch of soy boy. If you look at them, they are so smug. They are so comfortable. They are so effete and effeminate. They've never lived through anything. And what happens? What's reflected? The show, Rings of Power, isn't about a clash between good and evil, and there's different cultures that have been so completely fleshed out down to the last details of the intonation of their speech and the brooches on their cloaks. No, it's been reduced to a love story between Sauron and Galadriel. It's been reduced to, why did Sauron turn evil? Well, because Galadriel rejected his advances, so he becomes an incel. It's been reduced to the race of men on the island of Numenor literally saying, the elves are coming to take our jobs. Make Numenor great again. Like, everything has to be based on current trends, current fads. It has to be a reflection of, it is indeed actually a reflection of society. I think that's the problem, is that so much of art nowadays is trying to be a reflection of current year, which is bullshit. It should be timeless. It should speak to something much more intrinsic and profound than just whatever's going on now, because no one's going to care about what was going on now 50 years from now. Whereas a real story like The Lord of the Rings is still beloved nearly, you know, almost getting on now close to a century after he started first writing it, because there's something to it. There's much more meat there than just, you know, we made a funny, clever analogy about, you know, MAGA Republicans in our show. Who cares?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I remember, just to bring it back briefly back to Doctor Who, there was an episode in the first season of The Revival, 2005, called Aliens of London. And that parodied the Iraq War thing from 2 years earlier, where they were talking about weapons of massive destruction, and they actually parodied it. But let me see. I don't want to dignify it by getting it exactly right. They said something like massive weapons of destruction. Oh God! And they could kill us within, you know, because Blair had said they could kill us within. I don't know what it was. Blair said they could kill us within 5 hours. Well, these aliens in this Doctor Who story, the Prime Minister's saying they could kill us within 1 minute, you know. Mm. And it's like, that's their idea of digesting it and narratifying it. It's just to tweak it slightly, you know, but it's still perfectly recognizable. So you know exactly what they're referring to. It's just completely in your face. The polar opposite. Well,
because these midwits are people, you know, they're paid subscribers to New York Magazine. They want to impress their friends at the champagne parties, and they want to get a good review from their friends in the media who are going to cover their show. So they need to tick all the right boxes, and their inspiration comes from, you know, like, again, just being this highly intellectual, well educated, and also the things that inspired writers in the past, or creators, artists in the past, especially in Europeans, you know, they were inspired by, and they strove to meet the standards of men like Shakespeare and the Greco-Roman myths and the Nordic myths and all of these fundamental timeless tales that are interwoven through so many of our epics, our dramas, our fantasies, everything. Even all Jewish-made films from Hollywood have these tropes and these threads in them, references to Greco-Roman theater or mythology, archetypes that are so fundamentally European. Shakespeare, nods to Shakespeare. Whereas nowadays, all of those things have been demonized and actually removed from the literature departments at universities and the creative arts departments. They have been demonized and replaced with, Ungumbus and whoever else is supposed to be the flavor of the month that we're supposed to be deifying now. And so you now get this is the fruit of that tree. This is the rotten fruit of this tree, which is basically now just writers whose only concept of drama is, romantic problems, and who can't write great dialogue, who can't create great characters, and they wouldn't even know how, because they actually, for all of their education, they're not actually exposed to the great writers. They're not exposed to Homer. Homer's an old white guy. He's been demonized. They're not exposed to Shakespeare. Shakespeare has been replaced. His bust has been taken down. His portrait's been exchanged for someone else, some foreigner now.
Well, of course, because he saw things from a Eurocentric white male perspective, so therefore it's invalid. I mean, this is just absolutely outrageous. I mean, I had Ricardo Duchesne on a few nights ago, and it was a really good, I would recommend if anyone hasn't watched that one, I thought it was exemplary. And he talked about this. There's so much to that, I don't even know where to begin. But he said that we have our own perspective, but really there aren't that many other perspectives that are as advanced as ours. There's a reason why Western civilization was on top. There's a reason why people from other parts of the world venerate our literature, our art, and so on, and our science, of course. And it's not just because we were powerful, and it's not just because we insisted on it in some racist way. It was because it really was the best. And he made that case very thoroughly in that stream. But one thing I wanted to bring up, because you were saying about how modern drama, it's, and I love drama. I love this stuff. I could talk about it indefinitely, but you said that they are very tied to the here and now. So they don't reference Greek and Roman myths and so on, that kind of thing. And indeed, when they come into contact with something like Thor and Norse mythology, they have to mess it up. They're incapable of taking it seriously. Even the ones who would be inclined to don't really know how to interact with it seriously. But the other thing is that they're very tied to the current news, the current events. So their idea of Satan is Donald Trump. Something mm-hmm. like that, which in turn means that they can't understand Donald Trump correctly, because they're preoccupied with seeing him as the epitome of evil. So they can't even see, because he's not the epitome. He's an idiot. He's a buffoon. And you should see him, in order to understand him correctly, you have to see him as that. There's no point going around this diversion of seeing him as the worst person who's ever lived. And I would say the same about other historical figures as well. I mean, how can you even hope to see them honestly, if you've got this moral provider, if your scope is so narrow that there's no one worse than them, there's no one who could possibly be worse than them, so therefore they have to be the worst thing that's ever existed. It's all very childish, but it's also very myopic. And I think that the other thing is about themes. And I just wanted to briefly mention this, because the polar opposite of what you were talking about earlier, where everything is about the current events and all that. The polar opposite, in my own experience, is a program from 1970 called Manhunt, which is an absolutely wonderful program. It's not a Nazi program. It's British. It's set in World War II France, the resistance, but also the Nazi Abwehr, and also British, English RAF pilots. So it's all this stuff. And the thing is, the point I was going to make about it was, it's set in World War II. It's ostensibly, you know, the storyline is animated by things about World War II. But it's not really about World War II. It's not really about Nazism. It's not really about the French Resistance. What it's about is war and and human psychology. And I think that's interesting because it really, it could have been set anywhere. They set it there because that was the most proximate, appropriate setting that would be identified, would be understandable to the audience. But it's not really about that. It's about timeless things. It's about perennial themes. And of course, human nature, which doesn't really change that much. So yeah, that's just, I just wanted to bring that up because it is my favorite ever TV show, but it also seemed appropriate to what you were saying, just as a counterexample to the nonsense of modern drama.
And I think that's also an example of another example of why modern drama, why modern television series, modern films are so awful nowadays, is because they aren't, those timeless themes, those archetypes, to the extent that they exist now, it's only so that they can be subverted. And so one of the you know, fundamental archetypal tropes of Western storytelling is, you know, for example, the hero's journey. Masculine, what I was talking about, the vital barbarism. All of that has been subverted now. There are no masculine barbaric heroes. There is no hero's journey. The hero now, so if in the past, you know, heroes were supposed to be gallant knights like King Arthur and Lancelot, or, you know, Gawain and the Green Knight, or if we were supposed to be looking to, you know, plays written by Sophocles, for example, to explore the intricacies of the human condition, or, you know, the relationship between fate and free will and these sort of things, all of that now exists only so that can be subverted. The masculine hero now is, like I said, like with the example of Thor, is just a laughingstock. And he gets shown up by a female character because now what Western literature, Western art, Western drama wants to uphold is current feminism, or you know, instead of the trope of the hero rising above his adversaries and, you know, being righteous in his actions, now the trope that we want to foment and portray, or they, I suppose, the ones who are telling stories now, is the coming together of peoples, of diverse peoples, to fight against a common enemy so that we can have, you know, the whole sort of Coca-Cola unite the world messaging. So that's another reason, I think, is that all the things that you mentioned there, timelessness and, you know, depicting the human nature, the human condition, all of that is being sort of placed on the back burner because no, we want to show strong female woman. We want to show diverse cast coming together to accomplish great things because that's what we want in the world now. That's what we want to see in the world now. And we no longer care about telling stories. We only care about using stories as a vessel for propaganda and messaging, which is why they keep going to famous intellectual properties, because they know that they have a built-in audience. If these people, these midwits that we've been talking about, were left to their own devices and told, come up with a series, come up with a story, tell a story of your own creation with great characters who are going to be beloved for generations and themes that are going to resonate with readers, viewers for generations, they can't do it. They can't. Because they haven't, no. They haven't lived through anything, and they don't care about any of the things that are required to tell those kinds of stories.
Absolutely. And, you know, even a few generations ago, like let's say the 1970s, even then, the TV writers and film writers were men who, a lot of them had fought in the war. And, you know, in the decades prior to that, a lot of them had fought in the First World War. So they had that experience of something that really, they'd had that very tough experience, something that where things really mattered. And, you know, life and death was suddenly death was a very close thing, and they would have seen a lot of it. And I think that, yeah, I'm not going to say
I don't think they were entirely motivated by subversion. Like the thing that I'm seeing nowadays is that everyone is motivated almost 100% by subversion, by subverting expectations, by subverting norms, by subverting values. Everything, their whole motivation is just subversion. And when I was growing up, when I was a teenager, going into my university years, I was a huge cinephile. I love cinema. I would get in my car and drive to, you know, hours away to cinemas that were showing films that I wanted to see that weren't going to come to my area where I lived growing up. I poured over, and this is going to sound really strange, this is going to upset a lot of people, but I poured over and analyzed and adored the films of Woody Allen. There's no one more Jewish than Woody Allen, right? And yet, if you watch his film, his canon, like, you want to introduce someone to Greco-Roman philosophy, give them Woody Allen films. It's insane how many of his films are inspired by and rely upon Greco-Roman philosophy, whether it's the drama itself, whether it's allusions to the Greco-Roman philosophy in dialogue, you know, whether it's the title of the films themselves, there's so much. And this guy is a Jewish filmmaker, you know, par excellence. He is so Jewy, but he wasn't out in his films, you know, I'm going to subvert Western culture. No, he wants to make films. He's an auteur who happens to be Jewish and who loves Greco-Roman philosophy and incorporates it in his films. What was another one? Paddy Chayefsky, I believe, was Jewish as well. Another great writer. He was the writer of Network.
It's fantastic. Again, it's a brilliant
great film. Great writer of dialogue, great creator of characters. But his motivations aren't, I want to subvert culture. I want to subvert my host nation's culture. I want to subvert Gentile culture. No, it's, I want to tell a really good story with really good characters. And I know how to do that because I've also studied the greats. I don't shit on the greats. I can name other ones, but
it's an incredibly effectively told story. It's really, incredibly good, the script. The only thing that I would complain about with Network, and I guess you could say this is kind of subversive, is that he's got all these characters who are high up in the media, and they've all got names like, they've not got the kind of names that you would expect in American media, you know?
Yeah, but that's got like that's kind of
Nordic Scandinavian surnames.
That's kind of the thing is that I wonder if in comparison to now, I certainly believe that the subversion, the willful subversion, has gone off the charts. It's just crazy. It's always been there. Of course, you can go back. I think a guest that you're gonna have later on, Blackpilled. He's been doing this, for most of his career, as it were, in these circles, going back and analyzing the messages in films that you might not have noticed if you were just watching it with innocent eyes, or going back even as far as, the good old 1950s. Hey, look, here's the seeds of what later became, drag queen story time, and it's in the 1950s, or here's the seeds of what later became, well, I don't see race. Everyone, we're all equal. So what does it matter swapping out all these characters or et cetera? But I do think that it's become very much mask off nowadays over the past, 10 years or so. And I also think, perhaps I'm wrong here, that that's not just also in the stories that are being told. It's also in the way that the ruling class is presenting itself. I wonder if in the time of Paddy Chayefsky and writing Network, if the Jewish people who might have been in control of companies like NBC or something, if they were so open about it, whereas now with groups like the ADL and Jonathan Greenblatt and all the rest, they're just very open about it now. Like, yeah, we have secret behind closed doors meetings with the president, and we decide what's the agenda, and we decide, and if we get upset, we close down your bank accounts and cancel your business deals.
Absolutely. I mean, I remember.
I don't know if they were doing that, in the 70s.
And I remember after the 2020 election, there was an article published. I can't remember. It was very high profile by a guy who was Jewish, who openly said, yeah, we rigged the election. But he said we fortified the election.
Yeah, that was fortified that election.
That was where that phrase came from. It was from this article where he basically explained how they did it. So from their point of view, yeah, they are being more open about it. I think partly because it's no longer tenable to be secretive about it, but also partly because they're proud of it. You know, they're not ashamed. They think that they're doing the right thing, or at least they say they think that. You know, you never know. But yeah, this is a fascinating, and I'm realizing we've only got 15 minutes before Jared Taylor is due on, so we should wrap up fairly soon. But it's a shame because I think you and I could probably talk for hours. There's so much to discuss. And we've touched on a lot of things. But let me just go back to the notes that you wanted to talk about. Our general recap of things that have happened since you were last on Millennial in 2018. Can you do that in 15 minutes? Have a go. See what happens.
Oh, man. So much happened. Like I said, I didn't make videos or any sort of content stuff. I was usually just, you know, a YouTuber back in the day. Kind of abandoned that platform because that platform had abandoned us. And I just can't, you know, with any sort of self-respect, continue on that platform.
Yeah, when you said you were a YouTuber back in the day, I was going to say, weren't we all?
Yeah. So, like, when my life kind of got topsy-turvy for a bit, I just couldn't make anything even if I wanted to. I guess then, you know, I didn't have much desire to talk about things. So I went for well over a year without doing anything. I just kind of lurked on one of my old Twitter accounts and I just kind of observed what was going on. But I didn't really opine about anything or make anything until in the summer of 2020, when we'd already been living through lockdowns and COVID masks mandates and things like that. And then all of a sudden, sprinkling a little bit more on the shit cake, there was the whole George Floyd riots. And
how many memes I've got from that.
This happened in you know, somewhere in Minnesota in the United States. And then within a matter of days, I'm seeing the country of the United States is set on flames and people are dying in looting and it's just mental. And then a few more days pass and now it's happening in London. It's happening in Dublin. There's Black Lives Matter marches going on in Amsterdam. It's going on in Italy. Like not even English speaking countries or countries with a very, you know, good grasp of English. You know, the Dutch have a pretty good grasp of English. You can see how they might get swayed by what's going on in the Anglosphere. But this is happening in France and in Italy. It's like, what's going on? What on earth is going on? And so I was sitting in my flat and I just felt, you know what? I'm going to crack open the laptop and open the webcam and make another video and just get some stuff off my chest. And I started, you know, making video content again during all that time. And the COVID stuff, yeah, we only have, you know, such a short time that we didn't get onto it, but I think that it was probably one of the most life-changing events for me. It's definitely, there's like a, you know, BC and an AD. There's before COVID. It's marked the calendar for me. I know what my life was like before, and I know what my life is like now, and they're not the same. And the things that I lived through and the things that I had to withstand and opportunities that were lost, and also just for me, my whole way of living life and how I like to look at life was completely impossible. And I touched on this in a video that I think people did enjoy. I was trying to give some encouragement later on as we'd been through so much, especially encouragement to people who were trying to hold out and not get the vaccine, even though they might lose their job for it or something. And I think that those kinds of people deserved a word of encouragement. And in that video, I talked about how for me, you know, I'm a guy who likes to travel around. I'm a guy who likes to talk to people. I like to, you know, like I said, when I moved under that kebab shop, it was also right across the street from an Irish pub. And I used to just hang out in that Irish pub and talk to people. And that's how I kept sort of, you know, the demons away during this not very pleasant time in my life. Because I just like talking to people and hearing their stories.
That's kind of what I'm using. You didn't want to hang out in the kebab shop then?
No, not too much. I was satisfied just listening to their blaring Arab music late at night. So, but like that spontaneity was just completely removed from life. And for much of the past 2 years, it's been like a video game on pause where like, you know what happens when you walk away from a video game and your character is just kind of there, kind of bobbing, and other characters are kind of maybe bumping into him, but nothing happens because you didn't do anything. Your character didn't, you know, press X to talk or triangle to jump or a sports video game. You forgot to press pause. You walked away and your character's kind of just like sat on the sidelines and he's waiting to do the throw in, but nothing's going to happen yet because you haven't pushed the button for him to do it. And that's kind of like what life was like for such a long time. Like nothing happened because it was just paused.
Yeah, it's scary to think we're all 2 years older, and really, it was like just
that changed. We got older. Gone by, and you know, it's funny. I haven't been sick in 3 years, but I know that I'm not. Because I couldn't go to the gym, because the things that I enjoyed doing in life. There was. Do you remember that we weren't even allowed to go outside? We weren't allowed to take a bit of sun on the rooftop. Like the police. The people, the snitches next door, like people were completely losing their minds, and you couldn't even, like, people were, you know, running to take the rubbish out and then running back home because they didn't want to get caught by the police empty-handed, because God forbid that you were caught. Well, what are you doing outside? Oh, I was just throwing the rubbish away. Just complete madness. And so I know that, you know, that before all of that happened, I was a different person physically. Now I'm 3 years older. You know, when you get into your 30s, you know, you're not getting any younger, and your testosterone is different. Your recovery is different from exercise and things like that. And it's just like, yeah, I feel like years of my life have been robbed, like in that fucking, that machine, that torture machine in The Princess Bride, where he puts Cary Elwes up to that machine and like steals years of his life from him, sucks years out of his life. I feel like that kind of happened. And then I was, you know, just amazed at how many people, even within our community, didn't seem to understand the gravitas of what was going on, and even kind of poo-pooed it. And, you know, you were called a schizo, even by people that you thought would be on your side of things, people that are aware of, you know, the conspiracy of central banking, the conspiracy of demographic replacement, the conspiracy of all sorts of things that we know that the people who are controlling much of what's going on in the world. But suddenly now it was, no, this is real, and they have good intentions, and just get the vaccine and you know, just comply and stop worrying about masks, you boomer, you complaining boomer. And I just felt it was so demoralizing at times. And, you know, I think we've all lived through something almost traumatic, I would say, in many cases. And I know that for people in other countries or in other parts of the world, it might have been easier for them. But like, I was stopped several times by the police and the Guardia Civil simply for walking my dog in an empty street and I wasn't wearing a mask. I had the police. I came back. This was in the summer, I believe, of 2021, where we were allowed back outside. But you had to wear a mask in Spain. You had to wear a mask even outside walking in the streets. And I was coming back from the gym. I walk everywhere. I live in a small town. I just walk everywhere. And I still had my headphones on. And of course, I'm not wearing a mask and I'm all sweaty. And I get stopped by the police, who would run up behind me like as if I was, you know, a bank robber. They're running up behind me to stop me. And they're calling. Apparently, I had my music on and they're tapping on the shoulder. What que pasa? Like, what's going on? Where's your mask? Oh, really? Are we going to do this? Really? Like, just let me go home. What's the fucking big deal? We're 220, over 220 days past the date since the European Union said, stop with the masks in public transport, on buses, on trains, on aeroplanes. Enough is enough. The masks aren't that important. It's been they basically just came out and said the things that I've been saying since day one, which this is a theatrical prop. It doesn't do anything to protect you from a virus or whatever. And yet Spain, 220 days later, is the only country, as far as I'm aware, in the European Union that is still implementing these mask requirements. This country is obsessed with masks. And it's just so annoying. It's this constant little thing that's just, it means that you can never get back to, you know, 2019 kind of life. People are still wearing their masks. In the chemist, all the employees are still wearing masks. You want to take the train? You want to get out on bus? I've seen mobile phone video footage of people getting kicked off buses because this one guy in Valencia, his daughter didn't have a mask on. So the bus driver kicks them both off the bus. It's just mental. And people are saying, it's over. No, it's not over.
yeah. And Lichtman said a similar thing about Austria. They've still got that requirement on public transport. But the thing is, in Britain, there is no longer that requirement. It's over. You know, it's all like intents and purposes. It's over in Britain. And
in Britain, it was kind of optional. Like, you could walk in and if they said, would you like to put on a mask? You could just say, no, thank you. And they'd let you carry on with your day.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. It was a bit more laissez-faire. But the point I'm making is, even though it's over, we are not back in 2019. And so when
we say, never will be.
You know, the masks prevent us moving, getting back, you know, it will never happen. It has left a mark. It's changed us.
Mm-hmm.
It's changed, mm-hmm. it's changed society and it's changed people. And I think that's the
and the precedent the that they've example. Set. I think plural the precedents that they've set. It's really something. It's really. I feel like and I'm sure this could be said for a lot of people that there's this tension now, and that we just don't know what their next move on the chessboard is going to be. And now that the precedent has been set, you know, we can expect climate lockdowns. I shared on my Telegram the other day. They've had another tabletop exercise like Event 201. This time it's called Contagion Catastrophe. It's the same people, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. It's the same thing where they have this tabletop exercise where they play out a doomsday scenario. And in this doomsday scenario, it's a new viral disease called SEERS, SEERS. And it spread all over the world. And, we should have implemented the lessons we learned from COVID. We're still not prepared because we haven't, you know, basically uniformly mandated every country's policies regarding, you know, everything down to the last detail. And then the little cherry on top is that in their little, you know, tabletop scenario, this time the disease has killed 20 million people, 15 million of whom are children. That's what they're envisioning. This is how these psychopaths, what they do when they get together and they have their little war games, is they envision 15 million dead children. And so we're all just sort of sitting here wondering, like, what's the next play going to be? Did I prepare enough? Should I move into the forest? Like, what is the next thing here? And it doesn't seem like they have any intention of stopping. They have set precedents now that can continue forever. Like, after September 11th is when they, you know, think of all the travel restrictions, going through body scanners or getting pat down by some giant Shaniqua who's having a bad day. You know, all of these things, taking your belt and your shoes off. You can't carry a bottle of water. You can't carry contact solution that's over a certain size or they'll take it from you. Like, all that stuff happened after September 11th, and it's still going on. And it's still going on in countries that had nothing, that were not affected by September 11th. Yet it's still going on. This is what we're going to be living with now for years, because of all of the power that they took and the manipulation. And the scariest thing is that, like we were talking about earlier, the quality of people nowadays, the midwits, the people who haven't lived through anything. It was so easy. It was so perfect. This was just such a perfect pandemic for the 21st century, for current year. Not very dangerous, not very lethal. But because we have reached such levels of comfort and decadence and that sort of Trojan cosmopolitan comfort, we lost our shit, our society lost its shit, had a complete mental breakdown because of a viral illness of dubious origin and dubious existence that even if you give it 100% credit, it exists. It had a fatality, had a survival rate of like 99%. Like,
yeah,
that's pathetic. All of that change, all of that destruction, all of that, all of those years just evaporated from our lives for that. It's just, I can't believe it. So sometimes you have to take stock and like, did we really live through that? What was that?
I know. I know. And I wish that we could talk more about this. I really do. But I'm Jared Taylor is waiting. So
okay, I don't want to keep him waiting either.
okay, well, Roosh V Archive said, good conversation. Irish Nationalist Media said, thanks to both of you for your hard work. Thank you very much. And Jay said, thanks for mentioning me. Mr. Taylor never returns my calls. Yes, yes, yes. Okay, thank you very much. All right. So, well, this has been a great conversation. I really am sorry that we can't go on for hours. So I'm sorry, but there we go.
No, it's fine. It was great chatting to you again.
Yeah, it's been really fun. So people can, you did want to talk about Telegram and how it's useful and enjoyable. I think people, well, your channel is linked there. So I hope that people do get onto Telegram and follow you. And on Substack and on Odyssey and on YouTube as well.
Yeah, if you want to follow. I'm still there. I don't really post anything there too much. Like maybe once in a blue moon if it's something that I know won't get taken down or whatever. But I do Telegram live streams usually every Thursday. And then I upload those to Odyssey the following day. So you can catch all that stuff there.
Yeah, and those are good. Those are good. Like, they're a very cozy sort of atmosphere, which I think people like, and I certainly like. All right, got to end it here. So, Pox Populi, right. Thank you very much for appearing on Millennial Eight. It's been a real pleasure.
Thanks all for right, having me on.
And I'll see the rest of you imminently. Bye-bye for now.
We hope you're enjoying Millennial. The show must go on, but it needs your help. Bitcoin, Ethereum, Monero, and other cryptocurrencies are all very welcome. Get the info you need at millennial.com/crypto and make your donation today. Millennial amounts to 3 months of work for the vile blogger. Please help him continue. Until next time, enjoy the show and spread the word.